Casey,
back.
Head of the U.S. Army. And
I've slaved all lunch over your questions. Not so much, but a little bit. All right, so here's what's getting ready to happen. Many of you gave questions. We've had a conversation about what questions we think we can actually get to in a timely fashion. A couple of decisions I just want you to be clear about, just so you know. One is that initially we're not going to address any of the questions about how the Gottman model and Imago interface, because Harville and Helen are going to come up at the second hour, and they're going to, the four of them, have a conversation, and they all want to leave some time at the end of that for you guys to ask questions once you've heard their synthesis about that. The second point is two or three of you have said, is there any chance that you can get copies of their PowerPoints? The answer is no. Buy the book. There's a new book coming out, and it's called
The Science of Trust.
The Science of Trust by Norton. It'll be out shortly, and all of that material will be in it. It'll be out
probably June.
In June? Just breathe. You know, you can ask the rest of us who took better notes. Of course, they're written in a circle, and you know. But by the conference tape, better yet, by the conference tape.
Oh yeah.
Okay, so you guys ready? And still by the book. So first of all, thank you again. Part of what I have said to them, and I suspect I'm not alone about this. I've been counting, and I probably quote you guys about once a day in my office. And others of you do that? How many?
No.
Just take a look. I mean, it's a huge, huge thing that you've given. So, I'm going to throw out some questions, give you each a chance to answer in whatever fashion you like.
Okay.
And the first question is, can you tell us about your work with the military community?
Great. Why don't you start?
Okay. Well, let's see. Here's how it started. Several years ago, we got a letter, an email from a captain in Iraq who had noted that the signature injury prior to suicide was a relationship conflict. So it's a very new army today, correct? We have people who are internet interfacing all the time with their stateside partners while they are deployed. In addition, it's a volunteer army, and so there's repeated deployments over and over and over again. So somebody over there had used the Seven Principles book to try to help soldiers learn better relationship skills. And we then found out about Captain Christopher Atkins, who is a fantastic, brilliant, wonderful man in the U.S. Army. He is a social worker, and he had been stationed at Camp Liberty in Iraq and had taken the exercises out of our Seven Principles book, created exercises for soldiers, created small groups of soldiers in an embedded mental health clinic in Iraq, and used those exercises and group discussions to strengthen the relationships between soldiers and their partners back home. So we started we entered into a program called Books for Soldiers, in which we were asking if anybody would volunteer to send the Seven Principles book at cost, no profit to us, over to Iraq. And several thousand of those have now gone over to Iraq. Then what happened is, anybody know who Marty Seligman is? Have you heard of Marty? He's really he's a phenom, you know. He's just an incredible man. General Casey and a general next to him, General Rhonda Cornum, the highest ranking woman in the U.S. Army, decided to create a program called Comprehensive Soldier Fitness, which would train soldiers in not only physical fitness, but also spiritual, emotional, family, and social fitness. They also created an evaluation, a survey, of how soldiers were doing across those dimensions called the GAT, General, what? I forget what it stands
aptitude
for.
Aptitude test.
Aptitude test, yeah, something like that. Anyway, and that got given to 1.2 million soldiers, that general achievement or general aptitude test. I think they've gotten data from 880,000 of them so far. It's just incredible. Anyway, so Marty asked John and I to be the relationship fitness experts for this comprehensive soldier fitness program. So we first were asked to create four internet modules based on our skills, taught through an internet website to soldiers in Iraq. At that point, they weren't able to mandate that the partners do the same exercises because they only can order the soldiers, not their partners. So we created those four modules of four essential skills and completed those last May. Pretty crazy, you know, crazy deadlines working in Korea after our trainings that we were doing until 1 o'clock in the morning in an internet cafe and stuff like that. Anyway, we created these modules. We'll see how they work.
And what were your four essential skills that you're...
Let's see. Well, one was accepting influence. Big surprise. Army soldiers, you know, kind of believe they should be in control. So accepting influence was an important one. Another one was soften startup, right? Let's see. What else did we have? I'm trying to remember.
Open-ended questions.
You know, to stay in touch, because when these soldiers came back from deployment, they weren't telling their partners anything about what they experienced. And the soldiers also weren't asking the stateside partners what they'd gone through during that time they were alone at home. So, open-ended questions, and what was the fourth? There was another one. Was it self-soothing?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was physiological self-soothing. So
accepting influence.
Accepting influence, soften startup,
open-ended questions.
And
self-soothing.
And self-soothing. Wow. Right, right. Yeah. So now we unfortunately, we have to go back home tomorrow morning in order to submit a pretty major research grant to the U.S. Army by Monday that would be studying a much more expanded intervention in three different studies for soldiers and their partners, so the partners could learn some things too.
Randomized clinical trials.
Randomized clinical trials, right.
Throughout the whole deployment cycle.
Wow.
Right.
So. Wow.
So.
It'd be huge.
We're
yeah.
trying. We're trying.
It'd be nice. Nice to do.
Right.
Nice to do.
Yeah.
Yeah,
we've been interviewing, we interviewed 100 soldiers and their partners last year. Mm-hmm. To find out what the critical incidents are that are leading to thoughts of suicide or homicide. It's now more dangerous to come home than it is to be on the battlefield in either Iraq or Afghanistan. So the Army's very concerned, and the other services are really very interested in doing something for soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real challenge.
Okay. Thank mm-hmm. you so much. The next question is, have you discovered in your research any significant differences between heterosexual couples and gay and lesbian couples? Between heterosexual couples and gay and lesbian couples?
Yeah, we've published two articles in the Journal of Homosexuality describing these differences and comparing gay couples and lesbian couples with married, so we haven't looked at unmarried cohabiting couples, but married couples who are similar in relationship satisfaction and relationship length, how long they've been together. And what we discovered was that the gay and lesbian couples were were quite similar to one another on the interaction variables that we looked at and all the other variables that we typically look at. And they were significantly less defensive, more positive in the way they presented an issue than heterosexual couples. There was less power differential in the way they talked to each other, and a lot more humor in the way they talked about issues. So interactively, they were doing a lot better. Now, you know, should say the study's limited. We don't. It's not a representative sample. These are all volunteer samples, all done in the Bay Area. But what we found was that in many ways, we heterosexuals have a lot to learn from gay and lesbian couples.
That's right.
And particularly the way they talked about sex was a sexual issue was dramatically different from the way heterosexual American couples, you know, again, a representative sample, so should say that all of our samples are representative of the populations in which we work. So they have same proportion of African American, Asian American, Latino, Hispanic American, and Euro-American couples. And the gay and lesbian couples would talk about a sexual issue in a very open, clear way, non-defensively. I'll give you an example. Most of the time when we do research on a couple, a heterosexual couple talking about a sexual issue and making a videotape, you cannot tell what they're talking about. they're not very direct or explicit, whereas the gay and lesbian couples were very, very direct and explicit about what they felt, what they needed, what they wanted, and much less defensive. So two gay guys, one guy, this is an actual conversation, one guy says, well, who do you think initiated sex today? And the other guy says, well, wait a minute, you know, you don't have the kind of body that I find most attractive in a man. You know that. And the other guy says, well, I know that, but who do you think initiated sex this morning? Now imagine that conversation between a husband and wife. Imagine she said, who do you think initiated sex this morning? And he said, well, you know, I just have to tell you, you don't have the kind of body I really find most desirable in a woman. Now the lady down the street, blah, blah, boom, that's a body. And imagine her next saying, I know that, but who do you think initiated sex this morning? The dramatic differences in the way they talked about issues. That's what we found. Now, Larry Kurdek, you know, the late Larry Kurdek, who's done very, very extensive work, and Letita Ann Peplow, who's also done this work in gay and lesbian couples, has generally, with self-report measures, found really no differences between gay and lesbian couples and heterosexual couples. The book American Couples, that Pepper Schwartz did with Phil Blumstein, found that gay and lesbian couples and married couples were really quite similar and very different from cohabiting heterosexual couples. And she thought the longer a cohabiting heterosexual couple lived together, the more they'd resemble a married couple. And she found the opposite. The longer they lived together, the less they resemble a married couple. And the difference is really a statement of, I'm not committed to you. You know, I mean, if you get into trouble, you're on your own. But the gay and lesbian couples are very similar to the married couples. So that's generally what we find about those differences. So
lots of similarity, and then I want to make sure I got those other parts. You said more humor.
More humor.
I liked that part. You said that there is
less defensiveness
in terms of how a gay and lesbian couple might present.
And much more directness.
And much more directness. Okay. Great. Anything you want to add, Joe?
Yeah, that was it.
That's
great.
Good. Great. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
And we did design workshops for gay couples and a workshop for lesbian couples that the Gottman Institute ran for many, many years, taught by either gay therapists or lesbian therapists, called Honoring Gay and Lesbian Relationships. Our institute also was part of the anti-Proposition 8 brief. So we've had a real commitment to gay and lesbian relationships. And Julie's dissertation was on lesbian moms and their daughters. So.
Say that again.
Yeah, maybe I'll mention a little something about this. My dissertation research many, many years ago, 1984 or so, looked at the court custody situation and the fact that kids were being taken away from lesbian mothers during divorce proceedings. In other words, they started in marriage, had kids, wanted a different sexual orientation life, left when the kids were around five. And in court custody disputes, most of those kids were being given away at the time to alcoholic grandfathers, heroin-addicted fathers, anybody but the lesbian mothers. And there was no research at all with adult kids who had been raised by lesbian mothers. So my dissertation was on daughters who'd been raised by lesbian mothers compared to a couple of other comparison groups in the hetero parenting population. And 18 measures of social adjustment, gender identity, sexual orientation, big surprise, no significant differences. In fact, the kids of lesbian mothers did better on a couple. There was a trend towards their doing better on a sense of well-being and a sense of independence. And so that got picked up by the National Lesbian Defense Fund, and I became an expert witness in a number of those custody disputes. So that, and was on 2020, you know, when they were just beginning the process of lesbian mothers deciding to be parents outside of marriage, hetero marriage, through whatever, you know, artificial insemination, other practices, or adoption. And so the picture really got reversed, and Charlotte Patterson in Virginia did some magnificent research and is still doing research in that field about sons and daughters of gay fathers raising those kids as well as lesbian mothers. So it's a new world.
And basically two parents are better than one.
Two parents are better than one. That's what I found, right? No matter what the sexual orientation.
So hear the applause again.
Yeah.
Such an important issue for us.
But we haven't done a randomized clinical trial in the gay and lesbian workshop.
So right.
There's still a lot of work to do.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay.
So the next question steers us over towards angry, negative relationships. Yes. Wants to know where it seems impossible in that angry, negative relationship to find any kind of common ground. What do you do? How do you think about that? How do you approach it? What would you recommend?
Well, I would say one thing that we probably have a little bit of different orientation toward negative affect. And part of this, we share this perspective with Dan Weil, in that really behind every negative affect, and in some ways you could just eliminate the term negative affect, because behind every so-called negative affect, there is a longing. There is a wish. There is a hope. And part of our job as a therapist is to help people get in touch with what they're really asking for, what they really need within the anger. Mm-hmm. So an angry relationship, you know, and Dan Weil says this, I think, in a very lovely way. He says that as couples therapists, we have two challenges. One is voice and the other is connection. And yeah, people are talking, but they're not really being heard, right? So we have to help their voice to be heard. And then we have to increase connection, right? So even in an angry relationship, there's fire. You know, there's real energy. And we have to help people find out what the longing is behind the anger and make sure that we create voice and connection. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's harder to work with emotionally detached relationships, I think.
Mm-hmm.
That would be my answer.
So we have
a better answer even than that.
No, not better. So we have a number of interventions specifically that work on relationships where there's lots of attack defend. So, you know, I'm extrapolating a little bit from this question to perhaps, you know, what the person is meaning by negativity to be that kind of classic attack, defend, lots of criticism, lots of contempt, physiological flooding, and so on. And some of the interventions that we use are the following. For example, with physiological flooding, we teach self-soothing. So self-soothing can be taught in lots of ways. You can teach a couple how to do diaphragmatic breathing. You can use a little biofeedback device called the M-Wave, E-M-W-A-V-E, M-Wave, that's made by a company called HeartMath that looks at heart rate synchronicity with a little clip on the ear, and by regulating the breathing of the person, brings down, moves into better heart rate synchronicity and also lowered pulse. Some people do guided visual imagery, and they teach guided visual imagery to the client. Some people are taught to take a break, go read a magazine, go read a book, listen to good music, play some good music, do some singing. You know, there's all kinds of ways of self-soothing. And it needs to really be formed to fit the individual and what works best for that individual partner. But certainly physiological flooding contributes to that attack-defense cycle. Another is something very similar, I think, to what you do, which is when somebody speaks, it's important for the listener to reflect back what they hear that speaker saying to that speaker's satisfaction and then validate it to some degree before they respond. However, we also place great importance on the speaker down-regulating the way they're presenting their feelings or their point of view to remove the four horsemen, to extract out the criticism, to extract out the contempt and the blame. So it's as much the speaker's responsibility as the listener's responsibility to change that attack-defend dynamic. Also, Dan Weil, who is a dear friend of ours, a brilliant, brilliant psychologist in Oakland, California, has demonstrated a technique that we love, which is speaking for an individual as if you are their voice, only speaking it in a different way, with much more kind of some positive affect as well as really deepening what that speaker is saying so that the listener can hear it from a little different point of view.
And both of these techniques you're talking about have to do with self-regulating. You're seeing using the conversation, both how you're speaking and how you're hearing it, as a self-soothing device.
And in a way, we're very similar to Imago there in that we're moving attack-defend into self-disclosure.
And you see that as self-soothing?
I wouldn't say that, no. Okay. That part is not self-soothing. You have to do self-soothing before you can do that. That's the point. Because remember, if you're physiologically aroused, first of all, you don't have access to new learning, which they're getting in the therapy. You fall back on the old learning, you know, which is automatic. Secondly, you can't really hear what your partner's saying because of that tunnel hearing. From flooding, that means you can't respond to them in a way that really is sensitive to what the person is saying. So there has to be calmness and self-soothing first, then using these other skills.
As steps toward resolving that struggle around the negativity.
Well, we're changing attack-defend to a better understanding of one another. And empathy for one another. So not necessarily resolving a conflict, right, but really creating more understanding.
And I think you're saying that the longing piece is what you keep coming back to, that
right.
If you can, in any situation, if you can help them touch the longing,
right.
And you can help them self-soothe, and you can help them step into a new way of relating.
Right.
Sure.
Those are your...
Sure. But that doesn't mean you're going to eliminate negativity. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean, you know, and in fact, what we say is that you don't want to eliminate conflict. Mm-hmm. What you want to eliminate are the four horsemen. That's what you want to eliminate.
Yeah.
It's okay for people to express anger, as long as they don't do it with blame, criticism, or contempt.
Yeah, so that's your big distinction, is we don't need to stay away from the anger or the upset.
Right.
And what
right.
about resentment? Where do you put resentment in that?
Resentment fits right in. It's okay.
Okay, great. How about that?
It's a little different.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
Is there more you want to say about those, really, Nick?
Okay.
So this one is, how does the Gottman method couples therapy consider childhood wounds therapy work as significant?
Mm. Okay. Well, we have a process called, and it's part of what changes attack-defend, that attack-defend process between couples. And we just give it another name, which is working on the internal working model. And the internal working model means the inner world of the individual as formulated typically back in history, in their own childhood, in their own legacy, sometimes in their family culture, and connecting that to what we call the anatomy of the fight. So let me explain what that means a little bit. Let's say that somebody has a propensity to be extremely defensive all the time. So we might do an intervention like asking that person, is the attacking voice that's coming out at the partner similar to a voice that they hear inside themselves, about themselves? That's for yes, usually. Is that voice worse against themselves? Yes. Whose voice is it? Father, mother, you know, whose is it? Where does it come from? What did that voice say to you? What was that experience that came to you? Etc. And so is that, you know, when you're being defensive against what you hear your partner saying, maybe you're not only defending against what the partner's saying, you're also defending against that critical voice inside of you. So, you know, that's a part of it. A lot of my work is done with folks who've had severe trauma, either within family or outside of the family. So that is integrated into the couple's work, and it's almost like a piece of individual work that's done, but with the partner witnessing it and then translating what's happening in the relationship vis-a-vis that history.
I'd add that William Faulkner said in his novel Requiem for a Nun, the past is not dead. In fact, it's not even past. So childhood wounds, or any wounds that we take through our lives, basically none of us escape without some kind of scarring in our lives. They live in the present. So we talked about fully processing a regrettable incident or a failed attempt to connect, failed bids for connection. To fully process it, you've got to know what are the triggers in the present that really escalated people, created flooding, created, you know, a reciprocation of negativity or an escalation. And why are those triggers for this person? So that from the processing, the goal is greater understanding and greater connection and greater empathy for one another, right? Or what Dan Wild would say, you know, and I think Susan Johnson would say also, turning the conflict into a self-disclosure that allows you to really understand one another. So it becomes, and the biggest conflicts in a relationship are these existential conflicts that Julie described, where there really is a dream behind each person's position, so that the worst moments in a relationship also have the greatest potential for connection and intimacy and building a sense of shared meaning together.
Let me just add one other little thing, which is that I think in our perspective, and certainly in my own readings of the PTSD literature, I guess, you know, we may be coming at it from a slightly different point of view, which is that we don't believe that people can really totally heal childhood wounds. They're left with scars, and we call those enduring vulnerabilities. And so what's important is that couples learn what each other's enduring vulnerabilities are, so that, first of all, when they surface, the partner knows where they're coming from. And secondly, they can also be tiptoed around as well.
Have some compassion.
So you standardly then do look toward what is that internal system that they've come to the table with in terms of their histories and see it as leaving enduring vulnerabilities.
Right.
And
right.
See those as important for both people to know about.
Right.
So that
right.
there is the ability then to have compassion for self.
Well, it's absolutely critical. I mean, lots of evidence suggests that why do people turn away from bids? Mm-hmm. Is this a personality problem? Is this, you know, what is it that's making mm-hmm. people turn away from these bids for connection? A lot of it has to do with their attachment history and, you know, their sense of expecting rejection and expecting that if they do turn toward it, it's really going to work out terribly. Cassioko's research on loneliness is a good example of that.
His name again?
John Cassioko, mm-hmm. who wrote a book called Loneliness. Lonely people have this expectation that they're going to get rejected. And so they're very judgmental of strangers and have a propensity to see a bid for connection as potentially disastrous. So you absolutely have to think about people's history, and particularly attachment history, in order to understand what's happening in the present. And I think mm-hmm. and Julie's calling that the internal working model.
Right. And that's particularly true when someone turns away from a bid.
Right, or against, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Great.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Any more? It's wonderful.
Okay.
Is it possible to have a 50-plus year marriage to help?
Is that me?
Help a 50-plus year marriage if the husband is unwilling to join the therapy? What strategies are helpful to work with the wife alone?
Ah, that's, you know, it's interesting. A lot of people are asking that question. We got asked that question a lot in Turkey when we were doing a clinical training in Turkey.
The question about working alone.
Working with one partner versus both. So, you know, I don't know whether you all know this, but we have an assessment process in our work, in our clinical work. So therapists will spend 3 weeks or three sessions doing assessment before they ever do an intervention. So that's kind of hard to do with one person. When you only have one person, you're only getting one report. It's probably somewhat distorted. You're not getting the other report.
Well, not if it's mine.
Judy. See this? It's a halo.
Oh, is that what that is?
God gave me that halo.
God gave me that halo.
Right.
Yeah, so, you know, I think the difficult thing is to really know what's going on in the relationship. That's the first challenge, right? Because you're only getting one side of the story. With that said, I think you can certainly teach, you know, what we would do is teach the individual partner some of the skills, like gentle startup, like expressing appreciation and fondness, like turning towards the partner's bids and so on, for that partner to see if it makes any difference. One of the other things I also do sometimes is I will put in a call to the other partner to say, you know, I'm hearing one side of the story. I'm not sure it's really the whole truth, you know. I know you really want your partner to get help. So would you be willing to come in to just help me understand a little bit how I can better help the partner? And oftentimes they'll agree to do that in one session, for one session, and then I go to work. And then they
stay?
Will stay. Yeah, some of the time, not all the time.
How about that part about the question in terms of a 50-year relationship? Is there anything significant in your minds about how long a couple has been together?
Well, you know, one of the great things about being a researcher and an academic is that you can say when you don't know something. And I really don't have a clue of how to help a relationship by talking to one person. I mean, I think there's something intriguing about the psychoanalytic notion that the relationship between the therapist and the client may mirror the relationship that this person has with the partner, but you know,
not if
there's
splitting.
Not a lot of evidence to support that kind of universality. It's an intriguing idea, mm-hmm. but I don't have a clue how to help this 50-year relationship where the other person won't come in. Mm-hmm. Something's wrong. I have a PhD. I know something's wrong there. Yeah.
I think this is a pretty related question, but it has to do with if only one partner is really interested in change and interested in seeing the relationship shift. They might come in, but this question I think is about what if only one seems to want to change?
So they both come in, but only one wants to change the relationship?
Mm-hmm. To change themselves.
Change themselves or change the relationship?
My thought about it is, whoever's asking the question, but I think it has to do with the idea that we're so often getting the one person who says, let's go, and one person who's saying...
Oh, yeah. Well, that happens all the time. I mean, I think it's almost always true that one person wants to be there more than the other. But, you know, what that really comes back to is something that I imagine all of you recognize as incredibly important, which is the alliance between the therapist and each partner.
Right.
And so, you know, it's great that one person wants to change. That's wonderful. But you also have to really build an alliance with that other partner. And typically the way to do that is to just dig a little bit about how happy they are in the relationship. Because typically, if one is a little unhappy, the other one is probably not quite as happy as they'd like to be. Not that happiness is necessarily the goal of a life together. There's usually something that mm-hmm. the other person may feel uncomfortable about.
You wouldn't assume that the first thing that you saw was in fact what was real for them.
Oh, for sure.
And we have a different attitude toward resistance, I think. Well, maybe it's not different, but we view resistance as hitting pay dirt because that person is telling you what social process, you know, that's important in, you know, in your view for connection, you know, and building intimacy in this relationship is not working for them in life. So if they're saying, well, you know, I really have a lot of doubt here and I just don't know and I don't think, you know, then that's important to, you know, you want to really respect that and say, let me try to understand what it is that you're, how you're seeing things and how you're feeling and, you know, what's going on in your mind.
And that's what you mean by the social process.
Yeah. So, you know, once somebody says, no, you know, I'm not doing that. That's not me. And, you know, then
you're right there.
Then you know right there that's a really great opportunity to understand what, you know, where they're stuck.
As part of getting your alliances, then.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Anything more you want to say? What about neutrality? Do you see yourselves as neutral in this role as therapist with these two people?
It depends how you define neutral. You know, I don't think I ever feel neutral.
I was gonna say.
Ever. About anything. You know, I'm a woman. Up and down, up and down. So I think it's less about neutral, and I imagine a lot of you embrace this notion too. It's more about finding something to love in each partner, right? So really, you know, trying to find something that you feel, you know, that you love, that you care about, some suffering that you empathize with. I'll find myself changing my language kind of automatically with a partner, changing my tone, changing how fast I speak, changing how I hold my body in relation to each person
Back to the alliance.
Right. So I don't think I'm ever neutral. However, there are cases where I'm really adamantly not neutral, and that will be when I'm seeing abuse. So when I'm seeing verbal abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, lots of rapes going on in marriages in Turkey.
You'll take a step.
When I'm seeing, some real kind of narcissistic stuff going on, decision-making. It depends on the level of destructiveness, whatever that behavior is in the relationship, as to how intense I may get about it. But I've been known to reach down and touch a CEO's shoe, grab it, and shake it to kind of wake up. You're more neutral than I am.
I'm pretty neutral, yeah.
Yeah. It's a researcher, right?
He says interesting.
I have a more restricted emotional range than Julie does.
Thank God. Really helps in the relationship.
Sometimes I just view what's going on in front of me as my afternoon's entertainment.
That's great.
I think there's less of an inclination on my part compared to the therapists we've trained to really rush in and be helpful, mm-hmm. and more wanting to see where does this go, what are these patterns, and to think about what is, rather than to come up with the brilliant interpretation that will change their relationship, to think more in terms of the way Vygotsky, the developmental psychologist, thought when he talked about scaffolding, which is what's one thing that you can contribute, one tool you can give these people that's really within reach that will improve their interaction a little bit.
Scaffolding.
So it's like scaffolding for a building, that support for changing the face of a building, right? That was Vygotsky's term. So the best teacher of a child gives the child a tool that the child grabs and assimilates quickly, mm-hmm. and then learning feels like remembering to the child. Mm-hmm. And the child does not attribute the change to the teacher or the parent, but to himself or herself. It feels like a discovery. That's really hard. I try to achieve that. And I find that, I have to be somewhat neutral to really be able to do that. I'm not that successful at it. But that's the goal that I have in mind.
I would like to build off that to one of my questions, which has to do with the work that you have produced around teaching children, mm-hmm. and your early book on raising an emotionally intelligent child, because that seems like it's a very connected, and mm-hmm. and I don't know that that's that familiar to people, if you wouldn't mind speaking just a little bit about it.
Yeah, I'd love to. Well, 1985, I built a lab to look at the relationship between not just the way the parents interacted, but the way they interacted with their child, and the children's relationships with other children. So how is this family dynamic then replicated as the child goes out to build friendships and community and school and things like that? And it turns out it's all the same fabric. And the way to get at it is really to look at what we call meta-emotion, which is how the parents feel about feelings, and that goes back to their own emotion history and their own attachment history as children. And it turns out there are generally two kinds of parents, those who are really believe that negative emotions are toxic for the child to have, and so they really want their children to be happy. And they want to distract their child and minimize negativity. And those parents who really feel like your emotions are your GPS in life. And you want to understand your emotions. And they're more like coaches, emotion coaches. And there are really only five things that these emotion coaching parents are doing. They're viewing negative emotions as an opportunity for intimacy or teaching, connection or teaching. They're accepting of the negative emotions, even if they're not accepting of the behavior that the child is engaged in. So they may empathize with the child's frustration with a brother, even though they don't empathize with hitting the brother, right? They help the child to label their feelings and identify their feelings and understand their feelings.
That's number three.
Number three. They set limits, very important part of it. And then they problem solve with the child. And they're very patient about the child providing solutions. And these five things are predictive of very different kinds of emotional and cognitive development in children. And and it turns out that in the initial research, as we followed children from age 3 to age 15, emotion coaching parents really had kids who were better able to focus attention and even controlling initial IQ at age 3 or 4. The emotion coaching kids had higher achievement, and their relationships with other children were better too. So they, and as they got older, it turned out this was really a general emotional intelligence that was being created by emotion coaching. But at the time we did that research, we didn't know what was cause and what was effect. But since then, randomized clinical trials have shown that emotion coaching is causal. Emotion coaching can train parents to do this pretty easily. We have videotapes and other materials that the Tolaris Research Institute has developed. You can train parents to do this, and their kids change in achievement and relationships with other kids, and it's been replicated in Australia, and it's being applied in Korea as well. So, you know, we got this information from Southern Illinois and Seattle. You know, we plagiarized it from parents again, right? Not our idea, and it works. It works everywhere around the world. Kids are kids everywhere.
Yeah, I love the possible conversation about a co-creation of what we could do with our Giving the Love That Heals material for parenting and this. Beautiful stuff.
It's very simple.
Now let's go talk about another fun topic. Let's talk about affairs. After 20 years of marriage, how do you go about repairing the trust in a marriage where there's been an affair?
What fun. That's one of my favorites. I edited a book called the Marriage, what's it called? Marriage Clinic Casebook. Where I wrote a chapter on treating affairs. God bless Shirley Glass. How many of you have heard of Shirley Glass? She was a wonderful, wonderful psychologist who specialized in treating affairs, wrote a wonderful book called Not Just Friends, which really tracked how affairs begin.
Not Just Friends.
Right.
That's Shirley Glass.
Didn't I just say that?
You did. I just wanted to make sure some people didn't quite hear it.
Okay. So. All right. We've really integrated her work into ours. So, first of all, in the early assessment piece, we are telling the betrayer, whoever has done the affair, first of all, the affair has to be over with, gone, in order to continue with couples therapy. Secondly, we'll then give a prescription that, let's say it's the wife who did the betraying. So the wife needs to hear all the feelings of the husband, and that may take quite some time. However, the husband needs to state those feelings without contempt, criticism, and so on, without abuse. The husband also needs to ask the wife whatever questions he wants to ask about the affair.
In your office.
In our office, right. All this is in the office. And it's certainly suggested that it stay in the office. Those questions are asked, then answered. And it's also very important that the questions typically not be about what kind of sex did you have, what position did you use, etc. Because what those do is create terrible images for that husband that contribute to even greater post-traumatic stress disorder. And what Shirley found, one of her stellar findings, was that people who had been betrayed with an affair typically suffered many of the signs of post-traumatic stress disorder. So they suffer from hypervigilance, from numbed emotions, kind of vacillating with huge emotion explosions. They had intrusive thoughts, images that were very similar to flashbacks. They would have nightmares. They would have depression. They might have suicidal thoughts or, in fact, homicidal thoughts. Guess against who. So that needs to also be explained to the couple. In other words, the fact that the person is coming up again and again and again with those horrible images in their mind is not their fault. It is normal reaction to a very abnormal situation, and we call it PTSD. So the partner who's done the betraying needs to understand that. So that process could take quite a long time, just that piece. Then we talk about building marriage number two. Marriage number one is gone. So typically, if you look at the sound relationship house, the betrayal, the affair, has blown out every single level. How well do you know your partner? Turns out not at all. Is there fondness and admiration? Well, not as much as there should be. Is there turning toward? No. Turning towards the affair partner. How about conflict? Well, typically there's a lot of conflict avoidance. How about shared dreams? Nope, they don't know each other. And creating shared meaning is a big one. I thought you were this kind of person with these values. Lo and behold, you're somebody totally different. So all of that has to get rebuilt and built on a foundation of truth, of honesty. And that takes time, but it's totally doable and we do it all the time.
Mm-hmm. And I've got colliding thoughts. I'm suddenly looking at the time and going, okay, I have 5 minutes. All right, so let me just jump off of this just for a second. In terms of the incidence of divorce as a result of affairs, any thoughts about that? And then what do you know about divorce impact on children in terms of any research you've done?
You want to answer the first one?
Well, the first one is that typically affairs do not end marriages. That's not what predicts marital demise. Might be one of the factors. But as John has said in the past, marriages don't end with a bang, they end with a whimper. So, you know, it's
a whimper.
Like.
So this is Jijin Kelly's research and the California Divorce Mediation Project that shows that 80% of the time when people are interviewed about what really ended their relationship, it's that they drifted apart and were lonely. It was the end of connection rather than, and in fact, most affairs really aren't about sex. They're about finding somebody who likes you and finds you interesting, you know, and so it's because of the end of friendship, because of loneliness, that the affair begins. In addition to the processes that Shirley Glass has suggested, conflict avoidance, and which is in the service of peace, but it's also has the problem that people aren't bringing their needs to their partner and trying to get their needs worked out within the relationship, which is Bowlby would call effective dependency.
Right? Mm-hmm. Effective divorce on kids?
And the effects of divorce on kids has diminished with every passing decade. There are about 27% of children who have negative effects of divorce.
27%
of children have negative effects of divorce. And the work of Elna Maccabee and Mavis Heatherington has shown that the active ingredient is the children being used as a political football by the parents. So using the kids to get even with the other partner, the ex-partner, that's what really hurts the kids. Now, I discovered in my research that if one parent is an emotion coach during the divorce process, almost all the negative effects of divorce on children are gone. So the acting out, the promiscuity, the use of drugs, the drop in achievement in school,
can be ameliorated by just one partner being an emotion coach for those children, right? So that's really, that's pretty powerful, except sadness doesn't get ameliorated. Kids really want their parents to stay together and work it out, and they're sad about that. Nothing you can do about that.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of good news in those findings, I think.
Mm-hmm. Back to an earlier question about self-soothing. You mentioned several of the techniques that you used. Do you want to elaborate any more on any self-soothing techniques?
Yeah. I think one of the most important and most powerful techniques of self-soothing is really getting couples to separate when they're flooded, or when one person's flooded. And that means that they stop on a dime, not when they're finished saying what they're saying. You know, and if they get at least 20 minutes where they're doing something else, distracting themselves, listening to music, they're 20 minutes where they're not rehearsing thoughts of righteous indignation or feeling like an innocent victim, then when they get together again, you know, 20 minutes, a half an hour, it's, for most couples, it's like they've had a brain transplant. They're rational, they're reasonable, mm-hmm. they can hear, they can listen, they can understand. That's probably the most powerful thing you could do. Now, some clients have a lot of trouble when they're apart disconnecting from, you know, thoughts of righteous indignation and feeling like an innocent victim. They usually have very low vagal tone, which is a physiological variable that has to do with the amount of myelin on the largest nerve in our body, the vagus nerve, the 10th cranial nerve. And that can be built by, Julie was talking about deep breathing, self-soothing, meditation. There are some biofeedback devices that also help that. One of them gives feedback about heart rate variability, this M-Wave device. I like that a lot, that HeartMath makes. And it's a little tiny thing about the size of a cell phone, and you basically sit there with an ear clip, and a light goes up and down, and you inhale as the lights go up, exhale when they go down, and then you try to get this one other light from red to blue to green. And when you get it in green, you start thinking thoughts of mild positive affect, like, you know, what you have affection for, what you're grateful for. And that device is really pretty helpful. Another one is called the Alpha Stem. It's a device that connects on both earlobes. Little tiny thing, but it puts people in alpha wave, in brain alpha waves. Actually works. And in 20 minutes of sitting there with the Alpha Stem on, and you can feel these little annoying pricks on your earlobes as it works, then people actually become relaxed. They're forced into a relaxed state. You combine the two, and I mean, the thing is that people have to learn how to self-soothe, right? Not be forced to be an alpha. And so part of the challenge with clients who can't disconnect from righteous indignation and innocent victimhood is they've got to build vagal tone. And as they do that, systolic blood pressure and diastolic blood pressure go down. But you have to do it, like the M-Wave, you have to do every day 10 minutes in the morning and 10 minutes at night for 6 months to get the effect.
Wow.
Otherwise, you don't get the effect.
So last question in terms of positive effect. What mm-hmm. do you dream of doing next?
Going kayaking. Let's see. What do we dream of doing next?
Besides helping us?
Well, getting a research grant is my dream so we can keep understanding. I'm a research junkie. So
kayaking
I need
and
fix.
Research. There we go.
Kayaking and research.
Okay. Thank you guys so
thank
much.
Thank you all.
So, research to kayaking. Stay put. You stay put. Do you want them up here? You stay.
And now we're welcoming up Harville and Helen for an hour of conversation. Where you are.
my cowboy hat.
Your cowboy hat? Where? Oh, oh my gosh.
Your mic on?
I think so.
I hope so. Oh, so there it is in that. Okay, great.
Is it?
So we wanted you to see that we are one. Actually, I wanted you to see John in his cowboy hat. And the ranchers out at the ranch wanted to recruit him to be a cowboy. Little did they know what they would be getting into, but there it is. Anyway, thank you all for being there, and that's a lovely memento that we spend together.
Yes.
So I have a great deal of ambivalence about this conversation. And part of it is that I'm so curious that I'd sort of rather continue to prime your pump or draw water from your well. So just know I want to get there as quickly as I can. Because I have some questions that I think would be interesting to talk about that we've talked a little about, but would like to talk about some more. And I think the setup that we want is to have a conversation about what some points of interfacing that we have in theory, and what possibilities of interface we might have as we go forward, since we kind of came together as a collaborative possibility, and what that might look like. And I don't know what the answer to those things are, except I think the question of possibility is probably as productive as the detail of that possibility, because it opens up all the details that you don't have to have ahead of time. But the first thing is a kind of mirror of what some of the things, not everything, that would take the whole time to mirror back everything, but to mirror back that. And this is like a little bit of an interpretive mirror. The first piece isn't, but the second piece is. The first piece is to mirror back, if I'm tracking both of you, research-wise and therapy-wise, that there's a certain subtlety in relationships that is grossly impactful. Affairs start long before there's any sexual acting out. So there's a subtlety there of a turn away a year ago, 2 years ago, 10 years ago. And the affair is simply the accumulation of a distance and the need to compensate for loneliness. Mm-hmm. So everybody makes a big deal about the moment of the acting out. But if you ask when did the affair begin, well, maybe 20 years ago. The affair began 20 years ago. Didn't have sex until last week or last month or last year. There's a subtlety there. So there's a subtlety in terms of what would show up as a couple's problem. And there also, the other thing is that I'm picking up is that therapeutic change is also very subtle. And then both in terms of therapist intervention as well as client's capacity to respond to those interventions. Am I tracking that right so far? Uh-huh. That it's not, sure. There's an elegant subtlety in the in effective therapeutic process, so that to imagine that something dramatic will happen quickly or to try to create a dramatic event quickly, like a change or transformation, is simply to go against what is pretty clearly a subtle, accumulative, small step by small step process. So that out of that, I was sitting there saying that that I think what I'm hearing is that therapist patience is a part of a therapist effectiveness. that competence is related to the capacity to be consciously patient, mm-hmm. not just suffering and waiting for the couple to someday change, but it's a kind of patience that's a gestative patience. That is, if you wait long enough, the baby will be born, but maybe not today. So that speaks, and you're looking like you have a response to that.
Yeah, I don't think it's about patience. I really think it's about realizing that the emotions in the room, in the consulting room, in the moment, are a reflection of those gradual processes that have been happening for, you know, all the years before they saw you. Mm-hmm. And if you can get them to create voice and connection in that moment, you can facilitate that. So they're doing it in the moment with one another. Mm-hmm. Then you start building from there. Yeah. It's not about patience, though. It's about creating that kind of moment in the therapeutic
but
consulting room.
I want to dovetail on John's comment, because I'm hearing something a little bit different that you're saying that I think is, for me at least, as a therapist, very, very true. Really makes sense to me, which is that we're not dive bombers. You know, we don't dive in and, okay, make, you know, a magical change, and if we can't do that, then we're bad therapists. You know, that kind of thought. Personally, I tend to have a bit of a, it's almost a Buddhist, I suppose, little bit of a philosophy that every person has a guide within them that helps navigate what needs to change, whether that's within the individual or between the two partners. And so it's up to us therapists to listen to and to perceive what small little thing can change. If we expect huge breakthroughs, you know, in the first session or the third session or even the 10th session or 15th, we're going to be sadly disappointed. At least I would be. So I think it's really important for us to realize that the couple is changing in their own rhythm, in their own tempo, and it's up to us to really realize that they're responsible for their changes. We're not. We're not the great heroes here. They are. And so to the extent that they begin to approach one another, begin to create a little more safety, begin to disclose more of what's going on inside them, change can happen, but it's not up to us to force that more quickly than they're ready, you know, for it to happen. So that's the patience, I think, that you're referring to that makes a lot of sense to me, too.
And I think that what you both said is included in what I meant by patience, and that is available to the moment of possibility is absolutely necessary, because if you miss that, but if you keep wanting those possible moments to show up faster than they are, then you are not paying attention to the process inside the person, so that to sit and wait and then show up. And that all of that's kind of subtle. And then at some moment it could be a huge breakthrough. But I think what was impacting me is that your discoveries of subtlety, both in terms of how pathology arises, in terms of subtlety about how healing occurs, is a lesson to learn. And that you weren't saying that so much as that's what I was hearing as a sort of subtext to both the research and to the therapeutic piece. So I think if I took more time to Mira, I would take all of Helen's time. So I'm going to turn it over to you to respond to that. And by the way, the thing I forgot to set up was we're going to have a conversation here for about 30, 35 minutes, and then we're going to have you have an opportunity to ask further questions that have not been filtered through the the filter system that Wendy had. So those were wonderful questions that came. There must also and will be out of this conversation other questions that will come to your mind. So you'll have a chance to do that too.
Because what we are up here are for people that have thought a lot about relationship, and what Harville helped catalyze when he got relationship experts in the culture together in August was that everyone, all of these experts in relationships had been working in isolation from each other. I mean, they would come together to differentiate from each other and to compete, but never had they come together to forge relationships with each other. And so we are thrilled with the opportunity to use this 30 minutes to talk about our points of intersection and invite you all to, you know, maybe we can co-create other ways that we can think about intersecting. We know a lot about Imago, you all about Gottman, and so how can we, where are the points of intersection? So I think that I was going to mention, as I heard you all this morning, thank you for what you've done, four points of intersection, and just like the four horsemen of the apocalypse, these are the four bunnies of connection. I thought I would share with the Gottmans that we are so with on that. But I thought I would take a moment of vulnerability to say that 25 years ago, as Harville was sort of weaving the system, and I was a great dialogue partner with him, we were so excited about an exercise that you may never have heard of, but it's called the Imago Container Process. Yeah. And how many in the room remember the container process, the Imago Container? So this was, we knew, Harville and I knew, this was going to be the flagship exercise that would transform couples out of impasse and into joy with each other. And the container exercise was two people speaking very directly with each other about their anger and expressing their anger with each other. And we both had come out of the 70s when there was a real emphasis on go ahead, release your anger and the cathartic positive impact but of expressing your anger. And so we really, that was the central focus of Imago for the first 10 years or so, I would say, and also of our marriage.
And it really helped.
So you could tell that they know some things you don't know. But anyway, that they were laughing at our marriage. But yes, we, Harville and I, you know, really wanted to perfect this exercise. And so, and then we started competing at who was better at expressing their anger. I mean, we just went on and on and on and on. So then we were talking to divorce lawyers after 15 years of doing this exercise. And so we decided in our time of trying to figure out if we could avoid the divorce lawyers, we decided to see if we could make it through a day without one of us being doing something that the other person would read as expressing anger by look, word, voice tone, body intonation. And we didn't do very well. And so then we got charts in our bathroom, and we would have the days mapped out of the months. And if both of us got through a day without anger, we would put a smiley face.
They're laughing again. They're laughing. Okay.
If one of us slipped, there was a frowny face. We have read so many relationship books and written a couple. And nothing got us reconnected like the smiley face chart and the frowny face chart. It took that to get us to break our addiction to negativity. So just want to echo how much Harville had already created surprises and fun and all sorts of caring behaviors. But now that's what we focus on with our couples. And of course, when we came back all excited and told the faculty that we really thought the container exercise wasn't really the flagship exercise, we thought the other faculty said, oh yeah, we know that. We already took that out a long time ago. So Harville and I, we just love what the transformation in our marriage, and the fact that we really do, two people can really create an energy field in their marriage, that just by focusing on affirmations and all. So we're really with you. It's a tremendous form of power, boober. Two people can become conduits of universal love. So we really think that there's such, we're just beginning to unpack that. Then very briefly, I loved y'all's challenge, Bunny connection number two, the challenge to the good enough marriage. We really in Imago are very bold about, let's not have just a good enough marriage. Let's have the marriage of your dream. We think this is a real departure to Freud, who said the highest potential after analysis is resigning yourself to the misery of everyday life. That was, and then many, you know, that's true of much of that of the field, and it's only in the last decade or so that, you know, we're going for it. You can have the marriage of your dream. Harville talks about revision and really to a couple co-creating their future together. Bunny number three, we really are interested in the effect of the blood flow. You all talk about self-soothing, and we really do it in a lot of ways, and we haven't languaged it so much, but the behavior change request is a way that a couple with their frustration can be instructed to start sharing with each other their frustration one at a time. But the person sending identifies this frustration, then shares a memory of a time they felt frustrated in the past, which takes them out of the amygdala area to the limbic system. And then they make a request of three things that they'd like to see different. They would address the frustration, and then the receiver picks one of the three. And that moves the blood, the neural energy, into the cerebral processing, into problem solving. So we're very intrigued with the power of using the mind and shaping the mind by our thoughts. Bunny number four is this word trust. And I think we have a lot to learn from you all about that word. I think that's groundbreaking research that you all are doing. I don't know anyone that's working on that, but it just feels like it's ripe for all sorts of thinking. But I just feel like that the connection with trust, I think one of Imago's power is how people trust this system. The three steps of dialogue, Harville so brilliantly crystallized something in three simple steps and a few simple exercises. And I think people learning to trust that three steps of dialogue that then bring them into each other's love map and into each other's story and into opening the empathy is, I think there's something about trust that's at the heart of what Imago is and the reason it has spread around the world. I think to mention that in marriage, I've been recently reading about women in marriage and how their identity would be appropriated by the males, and came across a lawyer, William Blackstone, who created the foundational law in the West, and he said, quote, "By marriage, the husband and wife are one person in law. That is, the very being or legal existence of the woman is suspended during marriage, or at least is incorporated and consolidated into that of the husband, under whose wing, protection, and cover she performs everything." And this is the most famous lawyer that created the foundation of Western law, and that's what marriage was not that long ago. And the dialogue process helps two people differentiate, you know, move from colonization of each other or appropriation of it, separate out, differentiate, and move into connection. Separate out and then move into connection. So it's a powerful process of trust.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful.
So one other thing to reflect and mirror is your statement so clearly that anger is always a mask for an unfulfilled desire, I think is one of the most...
Every negative affect has a longing behind it.
And that, that to deal and get lost in managing the negative affect is not going to work. What works is to access the longing and see how that can be brought into some sort of satisfaction on each partner is a really deep and brilliant thing.
That requires a mental transformation on the part of the speaker.
Yes.
Which is tough because we tend to think about ourselves as pretty much perfect, and so that we want to give force to our indignation or our disappointment or our hurt feelings. And it's a lot of work to really, you know, stop that engine, that, you know, that locomotive that's going downhill, and to really stop and say, well, what do I need? And what do I feel here? What do I need? And what would be a recipe for success for me? And that requires a, you know, a lot of help from a therapist at first.
Yes.
Can I also, though, clarify a little bit that I think in our approach, anger is legitimate. Anger is valid. That, yes, there is a longing behind the anger, but that doesn't mean the anger shouldn't be expressed. Uh-huh. So, you know, anger, at least in our point of view, and also neurologically, for that matter, is a very primary emotion. It's an emotion, particularly, I think, that women are accessing and allowing themselves to express a little bit more. And like anything that we're doing for the first time, sometimes women do it in a clumsy way or in a way that is over, perhaps overstating, which moves into criticism typically. However, anger is really a way to declare your right to be treated a certain way. And to not be treated in another way. And as such, it needs to stay in the pantheon of emotions that are shared.
Well, the other thing I think we have to realize is that we are in the middle of a huge transformation, so that when we hear something like that, you know, about the woman becoming the property of the husband, her identity being vanishing, you know, we're shocked by it, and we're outraged. By that point of view, that, you know, that a judge would have that point of view, a lawmaker would have that point of view. And as a result, you know, we're really, as couples therapists, we're living through a wonderful time of the transformation of families. You know, 91% of men are seeing their babies born. You know, and in 1960, it was 0%. You know, and we had John Quinn being the first man who handcuffed himself to his laboring wife in California who was there, you know, and he was arrested for doing that. So we're going through this big transformation. So in our research, for example, agreement, you know, agreeability is a very good trait for your daughter's boyfriend to have. You want her to select guys who are very agreeable. But it's not good for her to be agreeable because... agreeability in women is compliance and becoming invisible. But agreeability in guys is great because it means they can really take their partner's perspective. So we're living through a time when things are asymmetrical. They're not balanced. And men have got to really, they want to have an intimate relationship with a woman. And women, if they want to have an intimate relationship with a woman, have got to really realize they cannot be dominant, domineering. And they have to respect their wives' dreams.
Yahoo. Can I applaud? I think I'll marry him.
So since we are running out of our time together, it's amazing how fast 30 minutes goes. I do want to ask a question because one of the things you've not talked about is the therapist. And one of the questions that I have and don't have an answer to is, can a therapist who is not integrated, healthy, and happy help couples become integrated, healthy, and happy? Or to put it another way, what is the correlation between therapy outcome and the therapist's personal health? This is a setup question.
Well, I guess, you know, I want to
answer... It's also a teaching question.
I want to answer the first question, yeah, you know, a little bit better, which is, can an unhappy, neurotic, you know, therapist full of psychopathology actually be a good therapist? Thank God, yes. Darn right. Where would we be if that wasn't true, right? So, yeah, yeah. And for that matter... For that matter, people, partners who are neurotic, full of psychopathology and so on, can also be wonderful partners and have great marriages, too.
And be great parents.
So that's, and be great parents. That's right. So you don't have to be a healthy individual in order to have a great relationship, either with kids or your partner.
It's not a drawback, though.
What are you saying, dear?
And is there more about that?
Oh, you know, I think it, you know, we want to use these principles that we're learning about to improve our own relationships with our children and with our, with the people we love in our lives. And you know, Julie and I, on the second day of every couples workshop, we start by processing an argument we just had. And we've been doing this for 15 years, 4 to 5 times a year, and we're never at a loss for an argument. And we're basically saying, look, we're in the same soup as all you guys in the audience, you know, at our couples workshop. It's just that, you know, we have a little more experience doing this, and we're, you know, we're struggling also. And relationships are, you know, they're not trivial. They're at least as complicated as flying a jet plane. And there's no manual. You know, so...
Right.
Yeah.
So my last question, you may have one. My last question, you may have one, is the sustainability of change. Yeah. Is there an invariant in sustainability of change, or is that a multiplicity of variables?
How would you answer that?
Well, I think it's... an unsolved problem. It's our really big problem is avoiding relapse. And what you want to do as much as possible is really transfer the skills that you have to the couple. You want the therapy to be as much as possible dyadic, so that eventually they're coming in and they're saying, we had a terrible fight this weekend, and you say, process it, and they do that. And they say, well, so we also try to connect, and, you know, we try to make love and it didn't work, and you say, process that, and they do it and they make it better, and then you say, okay, I'll take my check now. They do all the work, right? And so you want to make the therapy last all week. You want to make the therapy as dyadic as possible so that, you know, they're really learning. So, for example, you want to, as a good therapist, you want to articulate the emotions in the room, right? You want to do the kind of thing Dan Weil does, where you're speaking for one person who doesn't have voice, not getting heard. You're helping that person to really get heard by the partner. But then you want to say, as Susan Johnson does, can you say that to him in your own words? Okay? That transfers that skill to them, right? Mm-hmm. And then you want to have them take something from the therapy into the week, so the therapy lasts all week. And I think that's the way we start getting transfer of training, is that we're not the center pole of a circus tent. We're not indispensable as therapists. We're, you know, we make ourselves unnecessary. That's the goal of treatment.
So I love that. We talk about it as the portability of therapy, that a
right.
therapy is not portable, ain't worth
that's
having.
That's a good phrase.
Because right. Otherwise you like have that. Client, therapist-dependent clients And that's why they hang around for 3 to 5 to 7 years, is because they have no portability of the process. So I think there's a place we really seamlessly interface, is that we want.
But
I want clients out of my office as fast as possible.
Right. But it's an unsolved problem. We don't know how to do it.
And we don't know how to do it and to do that.
Yeah.
That's a left thing. So another piece of research.
Yeah.
Yeah. More research. Because I think we talk about that after our workshops with great poignancy, because you see these amazing things happen in a weekend.
Right.
And then 9 weeks is sort of my counting research. It's not as detailed as yours. After 9 weeks, if they don't do something every day, they're back
pretty much to
zero.
Yeah.
And so what was that? Well, it was a wonderful possibility, but it didn't result in a sustained outcome.
Right.
So Helen wants to make a
comment. Yes, just when you said we're all in the same soup, and I think your words were, John, and there's no manual. He says, like flying a jet plane, relationship as hard as a jet plane, there's no manual that we may have one, but... But I think the idea of we could co-create one, I think it's time to co-create a manual that was accessible for everybody, and that's the conversation we started, because I know doing a workshop with Harville about a year ago, a CEO who happened to be male stood up with his partner at the end, tears going down his cheeks, tearing up the divorce papers, and he said, "Just want this room to know I came here with my biggest enemy, and I'm leaving with my best friend."
Aww.
And if we can, and that was 2 days. And so if we can, we think there could be such a great, if we continue dialogue together, maybe there is a manual that could be required reading before anyone got a marriage license. I mean, at one time people were just throwing trash out the window. When I grew up, if you finished your coke, threw it out in everywhere, until the national campaign, "Don't be a litter bug." And, you can affect consciousness. We could co-create a manual. That's the conversation we're beginning to have. And we'd love all of you all, really, to give input on, boy, if there were a manual, what would it look like and how would we disseminate it? And what are these points of intersection? You all have read Gottman's work. You all have read Imago. And we'd love to hear more from you about how might we co-create that manual. Mm-hmm. Great.
And I think it has something to do with your comments about the process of therapy, that there are subtleties again there that that have nothing to do with the gross structure of therapy, but those points of intersection that are subtle. Mm-hmm. Right. But there must be... I'm a kind of a bottom line absolutist, monotheist kind of person. There must be some invariant that, if you could activate, would sustain relationship change forever,
I think so too.
And move us out of having to work on our relationships every day. That somehow the relationship would become self-renewing. There's something about the life force that's self-renewing. Why not? Why not that be a part of our relationship? Anyway, I think that sounds like more research project here.
Yeah.
So let's move now. Are you all open to some more conversation with the crowd? So we have mic runners, I think. And rather than going to the microphone, raise your hand and people will run. Is that what we're going to do? People will run the mic to you. It'll be a little faster. And we'll put this one.
I know there's brilliant people in this room, but will you keep it to a two-sentence question, not a backstory, so we can get lots of people in?
Okay. Hand there.
Where you want to start?
Hand right there.
Okay.
Okay. Who's got the mic?
This is on. Wendy does.
Except I need another mic over here. Or the get? Are you doing it? All right, we'll do it here, and then we'll.
Not working.
Do I get to go first? Oh, goody. Question about assessment. I don't think Imago focuses so much on initial assessment as you all do. So I'm just curious to know what you do in those first three sessions that is assessment, and how you might end up ruling somebody out.
Okay. So this is all part of our clinical training. In assessment, we have three sessions. Typically, each session is 80 minutes long. In the first session, the couple spends some time, first of all, giving a narrative of why they're there. Second piece is we do what's called an oral history interview, and that came out of John's research. And that oral history interview is narrowed down from typically a two-hour conversation to something like maybe 20 to 30 minutes with some very specific questions that are asked, and then watching how the partners answer those questions about the history of their relationship. And then in the third piece of session number one, we actually ask couples to discuss a problem between them, a conflict area, for 10 minutes while we are a fly on the wall. We do not intervene. We do not do anything. We just sit back and watch. We also videotape it, and we will oftentimes use some psychophysiological measure of heart rate, whether that's a watch that tests pulse with a little alarm on it or a pulse oximeter that also measures heart rate. And the little alarm on either one will be set to maybe about 95 beats a minute, and so it will beep if it goes over that. So we watch during 10 minutes of conflict discussion what happens. And we're rating all of those according to the variables, some of which you've heard about today, of what creates masters versus disasters. Between session number one and session number two, we also give couples a packet of questionnaires to fill out, thick packet. Typically takes them about, each individual, an hour and a half to 2 hours to fill out. And those questionnaires, again, are assessments of the specific skills and variables that we know predict whether a couple will stay together or move towards separation. You know, where are the trouble places? And they're also related to the sound relationship house levels, those questionnaires. They also look at domestic violence. They look at emotional abuse. They look at drinking. Or drug use. There's a measure of psychopathology. So they fill out these questionnaires, bring them back to session number two. Each partner is filling it out individually. And so we teach our clinicians how to score those questionnaires. And they gather data from those questionnaires that are incredibly prescient in being able to see what's going on with the couple. Second session, each partner is interviewed individually to get some family history, another measure of domestic violence, past history, affairs, and so on. Third session, between second and third, we code all the questionnaires. We put that together with our interviews to create basically a treatment plan. And in session three, we talk about that treatment plan while simultaneously educating the couple on the seven relationship levels, what's important about them, what the research says about them, and what they need to work on within those. We also solicit their goals.
Can I ask you something about assessment? In the not-too-distant future, we're hoping to have all of these questionnaires online and available to all therapists to use with their clients so that...
universally.
Yeah, so the clients can fill those out and the therapist gets a report of strengths and areas that need improvement in the relationship. And the clients can take these repeatedly during the therapy so that the therapist can track change. And we hope, you know, that, you know, everyone will use this, you know, assessment tool. These questionnaires have been validated against our observational measures and our interview measures, and they have validity at assessing all these processes you've been talking about, like love maps, turning toward fondness and admiration, how the couples deal with conflict, their strengths and areas that need improvement, the shared meaning system as well. So that may be one way that Imago and...
Yeah.
governments who can interface
and all
work together.
Ready for your next question? What? Oh, what might rule people out of your therapy?
What might rule people out? So when is couple therapy contraindicated? Is that right? Absolutely. Absolutely. So if you've got substantial domestic violence where there's injury, where there's a perpetrator-victim pattern, which isn't true, incidentally, of all domestic violence, where one person is, the perpetrator is not taking responsibility for their own actions, blaming the victim, in other words. John did a 9-year-long study of domestic violence, so we teach about that in our clinical training and how to differentiate between the type of domestic violence you probably can treat, situational, and characterological, which you cannot treat. So when you have characterological domestic violence, you know, get the victim to safety, period. You don't do couples therapy. When there's an ongoing affair, you don't do couples therapy.
Okay.
When there's schizophrenia, it's
a
little harder.
Can I say one thing about this? Yeah. we don't know what percentage of domestic violence is situational, but the estimates currently are between 60 and 80% of all domestic violence is situational. And the only treatment that's been shown to be effective is a couples-oriented treatment, which is against the law in 31 states in the United States. And so one thing that we can do together is to change the law so that we have a couples-based treatment for domestic violence that's situational with a good screening device so that we eliminate characterological domestic violence from that kind of treatment.
Yetta?
Thank you so much to both of you. This has been such a gift to be here today. My question is around the therapist and how we know that the therapist is on track with the work. So what kind of feedback does the therapist get from the client, if any? I mean, how do you track that you're actually moving in the right direction?
Okay. Well, certainly, what's the reaction of the couple in the process of the session? Are they able to dyadically do, you know, a new skill or have a second conversation that they should have had instead of the first conversation they had, which might have been terrible? Or can they process a fight? So in other words, we are typically at the end of a session, we're asking the couple, did this feel better than this other conversation you had? Or does this fight feel understood now? Do you feel understood more so than before? So we're always asking questions like that at the end of a session.
And you have your evaluation form online.
Well, and relationship assessment measures that we're going to have online also include the clients filling out a customer satisfaction scale on that therapy, how that therapy is going, as well as the therapist filling out an assessment of, well, what interventions are you trying with this client using, and how satisfied are you with how they're going, what kind of changes you're getting. So then the therapist can get confidential feedback on how's it all going.
So you know, great.
I think that's, well, to get his point, is a very important one.
The other thing, too, is that here and now we have an evaluation that clients can fill out at our main Gottman Institute website that is a series of very specific questions about how their therapy is going that they can answer anonymously about their own therapy, and that goes back to our clinical, kind of me, goes back to me, and the assistant clinical director, so that we have a way of knowing whether, you know, therapists are doing work that clients are appreciating or at least getting some help from.
Thank you. So I think this is a really, really good question. And one of the things that I do is ask the couple how they're doing in this session, and how did I do in this session? And was there anything else that you wanted? And what I listen for is, do they begin to feel safe within my office, safer with each other in my office? Mm-hmm. And they're not going to do that probably in the first session. But at least it gives them the power to not be treated, but to be related to. Mm-hmm. That is, how did I do and what's going on for you? I may not put it that way, but there's, you know, whatever question is, the moment is, mm-hmm. before they leave, I want mm-hmm. them to assess me mm-hmm. and also their relationship as a result of that intersection. Yeah. I think the idea of having a computer or pen and pencil sort of thing, also the writing grounds people and does that integration of upper and lower brain as well. But either one of those.
So there are about six questions in the back. Yeah. And okay, and so, yes, stand, and let's try to do real quick answers. Because
this is Larry Furstenfeld, and I want to make an observation and elicit your comments about that observation from a non-therapist. In the interest of noticing points of intersection, I believe I heard John say that the negative affect is an opportunity, something like that.
Yes.
And in the Imago world, heard the phrase, go with the resistance. That seems to me to be a point of intersection. Would you agree or not?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, they're a little bit different. They're a little bit different, but they are similar in thinking, you know, that it's really the emotions in the moment. And whether it's resistance or any so-called negative affect is really where the energy is for change. You know, it's an opportunity. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So just stand up and shout out.
Okay.
Who's got the mic?
Right there.
She does.
There are a lot of people who want to talk, so maybe I can just make a request. Harville and Helen, I'd really love to dialogue with you about the container exercise, because as a person from 20 years ago, I found it so, so powerful, so effective, done within my office. I can understand how the way y'all did it, maybe too much or something, wasn't effective, but I really appreciate you guys kind of acknowledging and appreciating negative piece, and I really love it. I really love it, and I would like you to, I look forward to hearing more about your integrating it in a balanced way.
Thank you.
Why don't you put this mic down? I actually don't have a question. I have a comment. I just really want to appreciate the research you have done on same-sex couples. I can't tell you what it means to us. And I also wonder what kind of force you put behind, I mean, how you made a statement to support or to put down Proposition 8, how you did that. Can you give us any ideas of how we can mobilize and move in that direction?
Well, what happened is that there was a group of lawyers in California who brought the unconstitutionality of Prop 8 to the fore,
right.
And the Gottman Institute was asked to sign on in support of their statement of unconstitutionality.
So thank you for signing it.
You bet.
Wendy?
Can you give us a snapshot picture of what a session would look like? Because we have a very clear idea of what our sessions look like.
Okay. And, of course, it's going to vary a little bit across therapists. So, you know, we don't have a exact specific model. But typically what it looks like is step one, the clients come in, how you doing? How was your week? Step two, what would you like to work on? and it follows from there. They'll bring up something, whatever that is. We're feeling distant. We haven't talked to each other all week, or we had a terrible fight, or I really want to deal with this problem, but I've been afraid to, so I want to talk about it in here. And you'll hear, you know, you'll listen to them talk to each other a little bit about what's going on for them in that moment. Pull out your from your quiver, you know, the intervention that makes sense in terms of what they're doing right there. Apply it and see what happens. Maybe it works, maybe it doesn't. Maybe you shift gears. Certainly, and then, you know, at the end, kind of check on whether that felt better, whether, you know, something has changed. One of the things that's really important is that if we see any of the four horsemen, we're intervening with that right away. So that's always right at the top. We don't allow that to continue.
And do you give homework?
Do we give homework?
I do.
He does. Sometimes I do. Most of the time I don't.
I make them generate the homework by asking, you know, sort of like what Harville was saying, you know, so what do you think we've been working on in this session? And what's unfinished? And then, you know, what's one thing you can take from the session into the week? And then they design the homework.
We have 5 minutes. We have one more question over here, and then maybe one more.
And I have one comment back here. May I? Okay. Right. Peace and love, everyone. John, I'd like for a moment to revisit this piece around domestic violence and intimate partner violence and share with you that for years now, I've worked out this paradigm that if there has been physical abuse, and what I mean by that very simply is anytime I use my body to prevent somebody from doing something that they wanted to do or to make them do something that they want to do is physical abuse. So when I do my assessment with couples, if I recognize that there has been perpetrating male physical abuse perpetrated by the male, then I will not work with that couple, and I will require him to go get involved in some educational program that can teach him how to be in relationships without using aggressive behaviors. And that comes from listening to the voices of women for years, talking about how unsafe it is for them to be in couples work with that energy. So I wanted to just for a moment revisit that for a second and hear more from you about that, please.
Yes.
Thank you.
I think you're making a mistake. Julia Babcock, who former graduate student of Neil Jacobson and I, who's a professor at the University of Houston, has done a meta-analysis of all of those educational programs. None of them are more effective than arrest. They don't work. But couples treatment, and Suzanne Stith has done this initial work, a couple's approach to situational domestic violence. And by the way, the data show that women throw the first punch or the first object 71% of the time in situational violence. So women aren't the innocent victims, and they're not non-aggressive. It's not always the guys who are aggressive. Now, characterological domestic violence is entirely different. There is a perpetrator and there is a victim. But there are fairly good measures, not perfect. The intimate justice scale is one. We have one that can discriminate between situational and characterological domestic violence. Situational domestic violence, we think, can be treated with a couples approach. And Stith used a solution-focused couples group. We're using more of a curriculum kind of approach, and we're just doing a randomized clinical trial evaluating the effectiveness of that. Dan O'Leary has done something like it, similarly in Stony Brook, and it seems to work and cause, you know, and the changes last, you know, at least for a year.
Thank you, John.
So I think it's treatable, you know, but you have to distinguish between the two kinds of violence.
We have 2 minutes. Can you do it in 2 minutes, Bruce?
Yes. I picked up your statement, this lonely woman had a propensity to expect rejection. Might she unconsciously choose a guy who is a rejecting kind of guy. And the base of a lot of our theory is that we do tend to choose the unfinished business from our childhood, sort of like, you know, children of alcoholics marry alcoholics, children of abuse marry abuse, not because it's familiar, but because it's still something to be worked through. And I was wondering what the research shows on that. I was wondering if our theory is really anchored in research. And I often was thinking about eHarmony.com, where you fill out a questionnaire to find compatibility. And we assume that couples unconsciously choose incompatibility. Right. And it was such a relief in the workshop when Harville had us all as couples turn to each other and say, thank you for being such a difficult couple. It kind of normalized the process. Do you feel there's research behind that we unconsciously choose the very thing that caused our wound?
Well, as far as we know so far, you know, and remember, research is very limited. The measurement of unconscious process has never been too reliable. But as far as we know, the process of selecting a partner is much more random than that. We know from Howard Markman's work, though, that in selecting the next partner after a relationship dissolves, that women tend to select a partner very different from the first partner, whereas for men, it's random. There's no predictability, which leads me to believe that women are thinking. About the next partner anyway. So I don't think it's as orderly as that. I think it's a very nice picture. And there's got to be some truth to it on some level. You know, this idea of unfinished business and trying to find a relationship that really works for you. I would say it a different way. I would say our research suggests that you find somebody where you can live with the perpetual problems you're going to have.
That's what you should do.
Maybe that's a different kind of way of thinking about it.
Which you are going to have.
Yes. Which you are going to have.
You are going to have. So we're at the time to end. And
okay.
I'm very moved by the two of you and by your generosity with your shared wisdom and your information. But more than that, I'm moved by your hearts and how warm and funny and caring and beautiful the two of you are.
Thank you.
And I am just so delighted to have you in our community, that we can learn from you so that we can grow and we can all become better helpers for the pain and suffering in the world. And we will be as a result of your visiting with us today.
Thank you, Ronald.
Thank you so much. And you are truly, truly amazing. Let's hear it. You are amazing.
And let's also thank Harville and Helen for joining us here, leading through the conversation. What a delight and privilege to have them amongst us. So the buses will start leaving in 15 minutes. They'll be leaving for a little bit, you know, for a while, but do go, get ready, go downstairs, and the buses will take you away. Thank you.